and support of KBOO staff. A big thanks to all of them. I'm going to leave you today with one more labor song, Out on Strike by the Rabble Rousers. Thanks for listening, and join us again next Monday morning for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. Until then, stay safe and stay active.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is listener sponsored. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBOO organic, independent, and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. But right now, during our fall membership drive, is the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us reach our goal of $55,000 by October 28th. Plant seeds in your community by making your tax-deductible donation at kboo.fm/give today.
Hi, this is Dwight Yoakam, and you're listening to KBOO.
Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, I want to mention that this is the first week of KBOO's fall membership drive. KBOO is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Not only that, KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. So help us meet our $55,000 fall membership drive goal. We're community-funded, so we need your support to help get there. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. And thanks for supporting community-powered radio. In late August 2021, after months of grassroots pressure, Portland City Council rejected Zenith Energy's Land Use Compatibility Statement, or LUX, that was required before the company could get a clean air permit from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Despite Zenith's numerous appeals, it looked very likely that its days as an oil-by-rail facility were numbered. But a year later, days before the Oregon Supreme Court ruled in the city's favor, Commissioner Dan Ryan announced that the city had cut a new deal with Zenith, granting them a revised LUX after Zenith promised to switch from shipping fossil oil to renewable diesel in 5 years. Now nearly a year later, a public record search has confirmed what many activists suspect Zenith Now, many years later, a public record search has confirmed what many activists suspected. Zenith cut a backroom deal with the city. Today we talk with Nick Caleb, a staff attorney with Breach Collective, about the documents he uncovered which illustrate how city commissioners colluded with Zenith, playing a major role in coordinating the efforts to push Zenith's new Lux application over the finish line. Nick, welcome back to Lux's Focus.
Hey, Barbara. It's great to be here.
Yeah, sorry you can't be here live. I understand you had a little car trouble this morning.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah. So here we are talking about Zenith. I mean, it's been about 4 years, I guess, six years that we've been fighting Zenith. And there's been an interesting turn of events. So I wanted to start first by talking about what you uncovered a couple months ago now, I guess, that flew in the face of what the city council has been saying publicly about why they wound up giving Zenith the land use compatibility statement for this new version of Zenith's proposed future.
Yeah, I'll give the quick broad overview first, and we can dig into the details that you think are most important for listeners. But yeah, the big kind of arc is that we at Breach Collective and a lot of our partners were really surprised in the fall of 2022 when we learned that the city was going to grant a new land use compatibility statement to Zenith Energy with no notice, no opportunity for public involvement or anything else. And it was very tricky. I called the decision really irresponsible at the time, and I still stand by that. And it just seemed weak for a variety of reasons. The biggest reason is that was a reversal of a decision that was about a year before to reject the land use compatibility statement, and a city was winning in court and preserving its power to deny land use compatibility statement on the basis of its comprehensive plan. It was a good legal position. And then, you know, so this about happens, and the city presents this great deal that they're basically, Zenith is voluntarily becoming like a renewable energy company. Amazing. It's lining up with our city goals. It's great news. And we didn't buy it. We didn't have all the details that we know, but it just seemed kind of fishy. We, along with several other nonprofits and a bunch of community groups, asked for a reconsideration of that decision with public involvement. And the city rejected that outright. Some of the staffers even were acting in, I would say, like a bullying manner, refusing to talk about it at all. And the public messaging from the city was, hey, we can't do anything because we just make decisions in the same way. We're basically these control arbiters, look at the facts, see them, and make decisions. And we didn't think that was a great rationale. It was clear, even without his record request, it was a very unique situation with it that was very much unlike any situations before it. But after record requests, we learned just how dissimilar it was from other systems that are like this.
Actually, before we get into the unusual procedure by which Zenith was able to get the second Lux from the city, I wanted to talk a bit about the city's position all along. Because you mentioned that the city had won several appeals that Zenith had filed with lower court. Well, first with the Land Use Board of Appeals and then all the way up to the Supreme Court of Oregon. But we were talking, I was with a group of people who, we have a renewable fuel study group, and we had a meeting with Donnie Oliveras, who's with in the sustainability office for Commissioner Carmen Rubio, who's one of the people that we'll talk about in more detail in a moment. And he was saying that the reason why they decided to give in to Zenith was that they were losing on every count. And we said, well, how can you say we're losing? And one of the things that Donnie said was that they were going to have to rewrite their denial because it wasn't strong enough. And that's what the each one of the court decisions said. And they had basically run out of ideas of how to make it stronger. What do you think about that? I mean, do you think that they, because I guess there was kind of an agreement that the first denial that the city wrote had a lot of holes in it that were pointed out by Luba, and that the city could address those holes. Do you think that their case was weak, or do you think, in fact, the city was winning?
So I fully disagree with the city's position on this, and What I read from the Luba decision was that the court said that the city absolutely does have the authority to deny a land compatibility based on its comprehensive plan. And the only problem with the city's denial is that they didn't issue substantial enough findings, which was something that advocates encouraged them to do at the time. Basically they equivalent of like submitting a paper to your college professor or something like that, and they sit back to you and they say, okay, you know, this is fine in substance, but you can fill in the gaps, like in your arguments here. And I believe that the city absolutely has the rationale readily available for making that denial with more information. They just want to do it, apparently.
Why do you think it is that they didn't want to do it?
I mean, at the time, without this new information, I just said, like, maybe they're just not that interested in spending time on it or something, you know, like a bureaucratic malaise. But, you know, after getting these records requests, it looks more just like they made a political decision. Sorry.
Well, let's just talk about this records request that you got, and what did it reveal exactly?
So the records that we got from 2022 showed a substantial amount of communication between Zenith and their representatives, both at PacWest Communications, which is a lobbying firm, and also Still Reeves, their attorneys, starting in early 2022 and really intensifying the summer of 2022 until a decision was made in October. And basically the quality of the records show that early on, the city had a lot of hesitancy to talk with Zenith, which is extremely small considering they were engaged in a lawsuit with Zenith. Zenith had sued them before, so litigation was ongoing. And of course, they should be reticent to talk to a party that they're litigating against. But somehow, by the summer of 2022, Zenith lobbyists had convinced several offices to be much more engaged with them and to actually take a site visit to Zenith's facility on July 29th, 2022. For me, this is the major turning point. The city and staffers from Carmen Rubio's office and Dan Rush's office, as representatives of the Bureau of Planning Facility and Bureau of Development Services, to go talk to Zenith behind doors at their oil terminal site. And, you know, when we saw records from this meeting, originally, Jill Shuna, who's the campaign manager, the chief of staff for Carmen Rubio, said, we don't have any notes. There were records taken at this meeting. Eventually, we came to find that it was not true. There were notes taken at this meeting by a Bureau of Planning and Sustainability official. And those notes, the notes are I mostly only record what Zenith said, but it looks a lot like Zenith a proposal to him, and then there was kind of negotiation that happened either there or in the days after that meeting. Because just a week or so after that, Zenith communicates with the city that have an intent to submit a second land use compatibility statement that will contain all the conditions we discussed at this meeting. So very strange already, very abnormal. I'll talk about kind of why this is particularly strange in detail as we go on, but from that point forward, the city basically acts as an agent for Zenith and helps them to prepare their application so that it can be quickly approved when it's submitted. And the level of access is really unprecedented at that point.
Now, I'm wondering if this shift in the city had that happened in early 2022. I think I've answered my own question. I was thinking that, Joanne Hardesty was still on the city council then. Things definitely changed drastically in 2023, I think, when she's no longer on the city council. But I'm wondering if you think there was anything going on in the city council that changed internally between the time that Dan Ryan made his very strong statement about how we have to stop kicking the can down the road and we have to stop fossil fuel in Portland now and denying the Lux for Zenith, that statement back in August of 2021, and then what happened just 6 months later?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right in suspecting that changes in the commissioner makeup was really important. My thinking is that when Lee Daly and Joe Hardesty were in office, there was a strong accountability mindset, especially as it related to polluters, industrial users, and big businesses. And once those two run council anymore, I think the personalities that that accountability don't exist on the council anymore. And pretty much everybody on council wants to be very compliant when it comes to appeasing business and industry.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM, KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Nick Caleb, a staff attorney with Breach Collective, about the documents he uncovered which illustrate how city commissioners colluded with Zenith Energy, playing a major role in coordinating the effort to push Zenith's new Lux application over the finish line. And before we continue talking to Nick, I want to remind you that this is a good time to become a member of KBOO. It's our first week of our fall membership drive. KBOO's programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, and people like you, and people like Nick, who we're talking to, who are so engaged in the community and helping, I think, to keep our city honest, to try to make them honest again. So you can join now and help us meet our $55,000 fall membership drive goal. We're community funded, so we need your help to get there. Just go to kbo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can mail a check to kboo.fm/KBOOFM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And thanks for supporting Community Powered Radio. I wanted to talk a little bit more about this shift in city council, because actually Joanne was still on council in 2022. I think, yeah. Was Chloe defeated in 2020? I'm trying to remember. So she was already off. So it was a single voice of Hardesty, who was just getting run through the ringer by other city council members, by the media in particular, by, was it People for Portland, who raised millions of dollars to defeat her. So I wonder if you think that kind of also colored the desire of the city council to move past the issue of Zenith and the controversy around Zenith, which Chloe and Joanne Hardesty had really embodied.
Yeah, exactly. Hardesty was in an election cycle. Like you suggested, the media narrative had switched pretty dramatically since the lockdown and from 2020. And so, yeah, very, very different political environment, and also big money spending again in our politics. And it got results in elections. So I think probably the city commissioners took note of and definitely changed their behavior. They were scared.
Yeah, actually, that was one of the hits that I've gotten from talking to people in the city, in the city council and their aides, is that there is a great fear of being sued. And I remember talking about that to somebody who was working for the city back in 2019, when there was that huge meeting at the University of Portland about Zenith, where close to 1,000 people turned out and were very adamantly opposed to it. And when we were talking, we were talking to the city attorney afterwards, and we got the feeling that the city attorney was just being very, very careful, so careful that it seemed like it was leading to inaction.
Yeah, and you'll see, I mean, the city attorneys are generally pretty conservative in the sense that they don't want to advise things that are going to get them sued. But also, the city attorney is the boss of the city. The policymakers get to decide actions of the city government. And it doesn't matter what the political orientation of the council is. They take risks, and some legal risks on things that they care about. So, for example, you know, you'll see in just the weeks past, city, even though there are state laws preventing enforcement of like substance abuse at the local level, city saying, we're going to take this on anyway, take on legal challenges. So it's an issue about priority. In this case, with Zenith, they have the winning case in front of them. So, it, you know, they may have thought that there wasn't 100% chance that they were going to win in court, but that's not the case in law. You never have 100% guarantee. So, but what they did have is a good legal theory and had clear administrative rules giving them the power to do what the community asked to do. They had dozens of organizations, over 40 neighborhood associations, tons of elected officials of the county and in the legislature, bring them to deny the influx. So they had the zeitgeist of the entire city backing them. And pretty much the only interest that put them to act differently are Zenith Energy and the Portland Alliance. Now known as the Portland Metro.
Well, I'm going to talk a bit about this proposal that Zenith was giving that the city gobbled up, which was we're switching from shipping fossil oil and fossil diesel to shipping renewable diesel. Like, that's going to solve all the problems. What concerns does that raise for you?
It raises a lot of concerns. I would say on the front end, it's not clear whether that's been feasible given what the supply chain looks like or renewable fuels overall. Californian markets eat up most production because they pay more for it. And so there's sort of like, and there's also limited supplies available. Zenith apparently wants to bring in renewable fuels from Singapore, which would be the result of palm oil, first like deforestation and sort of creating oils and usually not environmentally friendly ways, and shipping them all the way across the ocean, all going to cause emissions. So it's really unclear that that even results in carbon emissions reductions anyway. A lot of what matters are judging the carbon emissions of renewable fuels, the feedstock they're coming from, how do they go, et cetera. And you know, even the city is kind of presented that they would I don't think they've heard it directly because it was false, but they've sort of indicated Zenith to renewable fuels would be consistent with some renewable fuel standards that the city has adopted recently. But Zenith would be subject to city's renewable fuels rules because they don't sell into the local market. They're just a hub for throughput. So there's kind of like a greenwashing effort to say, oh, the city's got these good rules that apply to Zenith. That's not even the case. In addition to the very, very uncertain carbon benefit, maybe even there might be carbon it's coming to Portland. In addition to that, it's not safer in any way. If you put liquid fuels on trains and they're from a renewable, they still in smaller ways, it can still explode. So we don't really get any benefits as the public from this. The city gets a small greenwashing victory, maybe, and they get political. They endear themselves politically to Zenith and their allies, but as the public, we don't get anything out of this.
Well, when we were talking with the people in Carmen Rubio's office, and we were saying, they were talking about their problems with finding a lawyer that would help them write a strong enough case for denying the Lux, and they couldn't find the lawyers. And one of the people I was working with said, well, we can supply you with lawyers. And he said, well, we don't need environmental lawyers. We need land use lawyers. And okay, actually, one of the people said, well, we can get you land use lawyers too. But I'm wondering, what is the issue with the city? First of all, why? What's the distinction between environmental lawyers and land use lawyers? And why does the city have such a dearth of access to either?
Yeah, I mean, I know that we're sort of playing telephone and people passing along messages. This is basic, silly distinction. Lots of environmental attorneys do land use law. We have fantastic environmental lawyers in Oregon that specialize as land use attorneys. We worked with many of them in the past at Breach. So internally at Breach, we did an assessment of what would look like the things that the city would make and ran it against what we thought was like a critical leeway and thought that the city had plenty of authority here. So, you know, lawyers, I guess, differ on these things, but representing that this, like, there's no way they made an argument that the operations violated its comprehensive plan is farcical position, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, let's talk about this law firm that Zenith works with, which I guess has a lot of pull with the city, which is Stoll Reeves. Who are they?
They're, I think, might be the largest law firm in the city. They've been operating forever. They have a lot of clients, and Zenith is one of them, yeah.
So, I first got connected with Stoll Reeves around the Measure 9 campaign, the anti-gay initiative in 1992, and they were on the right side of that. But it seems like on a lot of issues, they take, particularly with labor issues, they definitely take the employer versus the worker side. And it, having clients like Zenith also raise questions about what their values are. Are they just a value-free law firm that happens to have a lot of sort of questionable industrial clients, or are they something else?
I mean, I'm certainly not the expert on all Stoll's clients, but they do represent a lot of who I would say are on the wrong side of issues on oil and gas. Represent a lot of like producers and owners of gas companies, and you just their name. You can find a lot of attorneys in their practice. They're kind of bragging about winning cases for oil and gas industry. So that's definitely a part of their client holdings.
So let's get back to the documents that you uncovered. Carmen Rubio's office and Dan Ryan's office claimed that there were no minutes kept of the meeting or no notes taken of the meetings that they had with Zenith. So what did you actually find when you got the results of your public documents request?
Yeah, so as it relates to this July 29th meeting at Zenith's terminal, which originally they said they didn't have notes of, we got a lot. We found out the planner at Bureau of Planning Sustainability had taken handwritten notes, and those notes basically showed all of the conditions that ended up being in the second use compatibility statement application. So pretty strong evidence that Zenith showed their hand and that he gave them some kind of assent. Otherwise, it's really unlikely that Zenith would have submitted a second land use compatibility application while litigation was going. So for me, it's very strong evidence, either at that meeting or days after, that there was some kind of assent from the city to move forward. And also, kind of interestingly, in the notes, there was evidence of suspension of public record access. So I originally got those notes in electronic form, and I got them with a name sort of physically, it would have to be a name physically blacked out with marker and maybe pen kind of scratched up. And I asked to physically inspect the documents because I thought that was kind of curious. The city didn't give an explanation for why that name was blacked out. And so I went to physically inspect the documents like a couple of days later, I think. And the name Jillian was written underneath the blacked out page without any kind of explanation. And so shows some things. One, that the state didn't want to know for whatever reason that Jillian, you know, was asking questions at the Zenith facility. I think they probably had dialogue that's not represented in those notes. We deserve to know what happened there. But also the city showing they didn't give any explanation for these records that they tampered with. And it's not the only instance of, you know, pretty clear like intent for people not get knowledge about how this was made. Emails from city officials saying don't put Zenith in our email headers and stuff like that. That shows that they were really conscious that they wanted to keep it under wraps and not have the public be able to find information about this.
And again, who is Jillian?
Jillian is the chief of staff of Rubio.
And what kinds of things was she connected to saying in the notes? Was it possible to be able to tell that?
No, it just in the notes said asked a question and then went forward. And you know, we have got out of these public records quotes, which is a lot of information. For me, it's more than enough to show that this process was not legally kosher. But I think there's a lot more. So the city attorney is claiming privilege over a meeting, notes from a meeting that the city had just a couple days after this physical site visit, which I'm quite sure would show of what the city's policy is very clearly. They're not giving that for their claiming attorney-client privilege. Also, city attorneys were in pretty constant phone and email communication with Stoll Reeves' attorneys, and they won't give us those documents either. So the city attorney may have served as like a go-between over in this decision as well. And so I think that there is information that's likely not being produced to fill in the gaps around some of these questions. Again, even with what we have, you can draw a lot of inferences pretty clearly.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBGL, PFM, KODX, LBFM, KMUN, and KCB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Nick Caleb, a staff attorney with Breach Collective, about the documents he uncovered which illustrate how city commissioners colluded with Zenith Energy and played a major role in helping them to get their new Lux, which allows them to continue operating as an oil-by-rail hub here in the Portland Harbor. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during the first week of KBOO's fall membership drive. KBOO programming focuses on our local communities, artists, activists, and people like you. Join now and help us meet our $55,000 fall membership drive goal. KBOO receives 80% of our funding from our listeners, but only 10% of listeners are members. Help increase our member ratio and meet our $55,000 fall membership drive goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214, and thanks for supporting community-powered radio. So what is the next step as far as, can you get these further documents that are being held up right now by attorney-client privilege?
We could sue to try to get released if we wanted to, and we're in the process of deciding whether that's something that we want to spend resources on right now. I would like to have the full story, but from where I'm standing, I think what I have already shows that the process is no good. And so there are a couple things. I mean, you'd before said, oh, we can't find an land use attorney that is going to help us write this. And it's like, well, land use attorney apparently was advising to do some stuff that's pretty clearly contrary to Oregon law. So I don't know who I'm seeking advice from in the city attorney's office, but there are plenty of steps remaining here. So the first is that the city has authority to withdraw a Lux at any time prior to the grant of a new permit. So I think people should still continue to call the city to withdraw the Lux and hold a proper public process, take information from the city other than just from Zenith, who have a track record of misleading regulators. So that's one thing that can happen. The city can change its mind. Politically, I think it's likely, but we still ask for it. Secondly, the Department of Environmental Quality has to go through the process for reviewing Zenith's permit application. And so they have, you know, sort of, I guess, straightforward responsibilities to make sure everything's, you know, in line with the air permit request, but also the Department of Environmental Quality has other review responsibilities. So they can deny an air permit if a compatibility statement process is legally insufficient. And we sent in a pretty lengthy letter to the Department of Environmental Quality making that argument in great detail, and, you know, happy to share that with listeners if they're interested. But we think there's strong argument that the process wasn't legally sufficient. The DEQ can do that on its own. And then they can also deny an use compatibility statement if a project is dangerous to environment or public health. And we make arguments this as well. So there will be some kind of process, like a 60-day comment period that DEQ will open up sometime. They haven't said yet. Could be late this year, could be early next year. That'll be a really important opportunity for the public to be involved. And then there are also smaller public processes that are kind of in the wake of this Saturn deal between Venus and the City of Portland. People should still stay involved in. For example, on September 29th, this Friday, there's a comment period deadline for decision that the Bureau of Development Services is making over whether to grant permission for 3 new pipes under Front Avenue from the Zenith facility to the salt oil facility. Zenith said that it will use those pipes for renewable fuels, and this is a request that got denied by a more friendly city council in 2019, and so they're making the same request again. And, you know, one of the problems with that is that if pipes are built, it will free up additional capacity for fossil fuel operations. And so we could see a situation, if Zenith gets everything that it wants, where we have a greater volume of liquid fuels coming through the critical infrastructure hub. We need to be reducing those pretty dramatically for public health and safety.
So how kind of media coverage are you getting about this? I mean, it seems like the story, which was broken in Street Roots in an excellent article, and then in a really, really good article by Nick Cunningham in DSMOG blog, it sounded pretty outrageous. But I'm wondering if it's getting coverage in the wider media and how to get that coverage if you aren't getting it so far.
So from what I've seen, DSMOG had really strong coverage, really detailed coverage. Three Roots run 2 articles on this, and I expect they'll continue to run articles. It's great that our local investigative analysts are getting involved. The Mercury has been somewhat attentive to this. They've been attentive over the past. They had coverage of the climate strike this last weekend, and then I think I've seen some of these articles linked in OP articles, kind of buried in coverage. But yeah, I agree that for an issue that you care this much about in this city, it seems like you would expect more media coverage of it. And so it has been a little bit surprising that it hasn't really entered the legacy media market as much. And I don't know why that is, you know. Is probably it's kind of a complex issue. Maybe journalists are looking for like a hook that's new before they report on it. I'm not entirely sure why it hasn't really come into the mainstream media coverage.
I'm kind of curious if Gosia, who writes for the Oregonian, who's been doing excellent environmental coverage, if she's on this yet. I mean, she's covered some other stuff that's been quite controversial, and I'm amazed the Oregonian gives her as free a rein as they do. Is anybody talking to her?
I don't think that she's going to cover this issue, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that the Oregonian gave pretty good coverage to the climate strike. It was interesting to see how much local, regional, national coverage the climate strike got. It was very heartening. And there'd be little mentions of Zenith in it, but nothing about just how undermanned this deal was that the city managed to pull off with Zenith. I just wonder if you have any thoughts about how to get this story out in other ways than what you've already tried.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of action that's spinning around Zenith. It continues to happen. So several weeks ago, some activists with Extinction Rebellion went to blockade an oil tanker out on the limit, for example. And I expect that people will continue to organize around it. So when people organize, oftentimes there's new coverage that follows it. So that's one thing that happens. But, you know, we continue to raise the alarm bells on this. I think, you know, one interpretation of the lack of media coverage has to do with some success in the greenwashing branding Zenith and the City of Portland did. And maybe so just like some kind of like cynicism of being like, yeah, of course, political officials are doing groom deals and people think that that's normal and par for these days. I don't generally like to lead to that. I think we should hold our elected officials to high levels of accountability, but I've seen coverage around like Secretary of State, former Secretary of State, Kimia Fagan. There's a lot going on around for Labor Commissioner Val Hoyle lately. And this to me seems in line with that type of you know, not above board behavior of elected officials.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking about how to get that, like, to talk a little bit more about just how underhanded this was, and how let's just talk a little bit more about some of the things that seem to be that kind of maybe actually fulfilled some of the suspicions that you had of what was going on. Because a lot of us, before you really you got these documents, it showed that in fact the city commissioners and Zenith were in collusion to get this new Lux written, that there, something must have gone on. I mean, people have been saying, talking for a year about how there must have been some kind of corruption. So I wonder how we continue to talk about that. And, yeah. And what you see in particular that you would want to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are elements of this that are not as complicated, that are more easy to cover, even for journalists who are not wanting to, like, you know, become experts in this issue. And one of those just hiding words, right? Like trying to make things inaccessible. When somebody's committing crime, like that's one of the things that somebody looks for, right? Is just like, oh, you know, are they trying to hide evidence of something? And so I would hope that that on its own would be reasons for people looking deeper. Also, you know, we'll probably talk about this more later, but hired really experienced lobbyists to represent them and advocate for a position in front of the council. And they didn't file lobbying reports with the city. These are very experienced lobbyists, and that's kind of strange.
By the way, you've been cutting out a lot through this whole interview, and I'm hoping people can kind of get the gist of what you're saying. But what were you saying about the lobbyists that Zenith hired? What was suspicious about that?
Well, they're very experienced, and they didn't file lobbying reports after really extensive conversations with city council, including these site visits and preparing new information. And that, to me, is just sort of indicative of the desire that everybody had to keep it under wraps. So you'd think journalists would look closely at that. I think there's also, from a lawyer standpoint, something that stood out to me right away was that there was an active lawsuit happening and other parties involved with the case. The Columbia River Keeper and Willamette River Keeper had entered to defend the city's position of denying the influx, and the city never communicated with them about any of these discussions that it was having with Zenith Energy.
Right, so they weren't communicating with Willamette River Keeper or Columbia River Keeper?
Yeah, and so in legal they were having ex parte communications with Zenith, and they weren't putting the record, which is a no-no. And, you know, why would they do that? And it's pretty clear to me that they didn't want the environmentalists knowing that these conversations happening. So even when you don't look at the kind of, like, technical pieces of this, I think there are a lot of elements of the story that just show, like, the intentional desire to keep the public knowing about any of this. And my mission, based on some of the public records that came up for, like, Anne Ryan's office, is that they were caught off guard in 2021, this huge wave of public opposition to ZenithCom and pressure on them to deny that Lux. And I think that they wanted to avoid they wanted to have everything done and formalized before the public got any opportunity to evolve itself or raise hell, basically. And they basically made a decision that, like, they're not scared of environmentalists, and so they could deal with challenges and grumbles later, but more worried about Venus and what a Portland business law, I think. So for me, this is scandalous, but I also see the makeup of some of the legacy media and who owns in their element in the Portland business coalitions, and it doesn't surprise me, I guess, compared to other coverage.
And I want to remind you that you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Nick Caleb, a staff attorney with Breach Collective, about the documents he uncovered which illustrate how city commissioners colluded with Zenith Energy, playing a major role in coordinating the effort to push Zenith's new Lux application over the finish line. And I want to remind you that this is a good time to become a member of KBOO during the first week of KBOO's fall membership drive. KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. So please support this vital community institution and help us meet our $55,000 fall membership drive goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Well, you said that the city council is not as afraid of grassroots organizers who've been fighting Zenith for 6 years as they are of the oil industry. So how do we make them as afraid of us as they are of the oil industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons that that's the case is that a lot of people on the city council, I think maybe everybody except for Wheeler, came into office after the pandemic lockdown, right? And so they never actually witnessed or saw the depth of community organizing this city around climate issues and health and safety issues around oil cranes. For anybody who was present between like 2013 and 2019 who was paying attention, you've seen thousands of Portlanders getting involved, dozens of organizations, neighborhood associations, legislators, all saying in that we don't want this type of development in our city. And those folks that are making the decision, I just don't think they've seen the full force of that organizing take place. And so what they see is big money spending on political advertisements and campaign contributions, park money campaigns, and the things that they're scared of. So for all of this type of work, especially on the climate side, we don't have as many resources as business. We have to organize. We have to organize well, visibly. We have to organize intelligently and kind of in sometimes like a way so that people will join us. I think if organizing capacity gets back to the level that it was pre-pandemic lockdown, then I think that we'll be in a good position to demonstrate to them and the rest of the city these are not issues that are ancillary or when Portland don't care about. Like, this is a very climate-conscious city. This is a city that doesn't want to be exposed to the dangers of the fossil fuel industry. And we've organized strongly on it before, and we'll continue to do so.
Well, actually, I thought that the climate strike last week really showed that power. However, there's a difference between marching in the streets at noon and taking over City Hall. And I think a couple weeks ago, people did show up at City Hall, in fact, packed City Hall, to protest the backroom deal between Zenith and Ryan and Rubio's offices. And it was interesting. There was a very passionate testimony given by this young man, and that was connected to the bicycle activists who were calling for the city to create safe bike paths. And one of the bicycle activists who spoke before we spoke about the backroom deal connected the city's lack of action and saving lives for bicyclists and risking all our lives with the CEI hub and the impending danger there in Zenith Oil. So it was great while it was going on, but then Ted Wheeler cleared the room and was very adamant about clearing the room, and people eventually left. So I'm wondering, how do we, for one thing, get onto the city council agenda, maybe, so that we actually can start having the kinds of hearings about this and bringing it to the city council's attention every week, as people did all the way back to the 2013 when they were fighting the Pembina liquid propane terminal that was supposed to be built right across right at the edge of the CEI hub, and also all the fighting against Zenith, which went on and on and on, not to mention getting the ban on future fossil fuel infrastructure passed in 2016.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm not saying that people shouldn't try, but I don't think it's likely that Dan Ryan and Carmen Rubio and staff are going to do mea culpa and say sorry on this and a bunch of other shit. Just like, seems like they have a political orientation that they've established, like they've made political calculation. It's, you know, no small secret that a good number of the people on city council are mulling over like mayoral elections, and so their inclination and opinion is going to be like showing big business that they're totally in line with the things that the PBA and developers and industry want. So I don't think we're getting a fair hearing from this council goes. You know, luckily in the case of Zenith, they're not just have to ask the city. That's, we have opportunities to raise concerns with the state. There are going to be open processes there. And, you know, I will not say anything in detail about this to note that there are elections coming up in a new form of government. So people who are really concerned about the makeup of power will have an opportunity in about a year's time here to do something.
Well, one more point. I read in another article in Street Roots last week that you have filed a complaint with the city auditor about the violation of lobbying laws that was followed by the lobbyist on behalf of Zenith. So I'm wondering, what do you see, how do you see that playing out?
Yeah, it's, I mean, we'll see. I think Jeremiah Hayden and Roots had really good coverage of this. He released it on the day of the climate strike. And also noted that it's rare that the auditor will issue a penalty around this stuff. But I think in terms of demonstrating that this process was good, it's important that the auditor take a look at this. So they are. So we submitted the lobbying complaint, I guess the named person in complaint, to the city auditor. They have a formal process for submitting complaints, so you just send an email to their elections person, basically. But now, you know, after we had received all these public records, I was like, look, a lot of communication happening here. It doesn't seem like any of the exceptions in city code apply to this. And I don't understand how this amount of lobbying could be under $8 or $1,000 in a council order. So, you know, take a look at this. And I hope that they come out with a strong denunciation of that and a penalty.
So I'm a little unclear what you just said, but so you're saying, do you have any hope that there'll actually be some kind of penalty, or do you think this is just going to go under the radar again?
I mean, I think there's clear evidence in the record to suggest that that's likely violated lobbying laws. And so I, you know, I'm waiting for investigation from the auditor's office. Historically, they haven't issued like large penalties, but they have. They have issued lobbying violent penalties in the past. And it's my understanding that they also recently got access to independent counsel rather than having to rely on the city's attorneys, which in this case is really important because the city attorneys were deeply involved in the coordination of Zenith. So we wouldn't want them to be sort of issuing opinions about whether it was COVID or not. So that access to independent counsel that the auditor's office has pretty recent is good for someone like me who wants to see accountability.
Well, I read an article, it was either in the Willamette Week or the Oregonian in the last few days, talking about the ongoing political shuffle that's about to happen in Portland City Hall with the new charter change going into effect, expanded city council, and a different kind of mayor, and mentioning all the people that are being rumored to run for mayor. One of them is Carmen Rubio. And it was interesting to see that the article mentioned that Carmen Rubio is coming under fire from environmentalists who were a very strong part of her backing when she got elected to begin with. I'm wondering if you see in that kind of writing in a relatively mainstream media outlet in Portland that this could be a way to target Carmen Rubio to either become more accountable or not to run.
I mean, I hope so. I hope that she and her office are feeling the pressure and maybe finally understanding how important this issue is to Portlanders. And that, yeah, in terms of politics, maybe, you know, the support of a Houston-based fossil fuel distributor would be less important than, you know, the coalition that got you elected the first time. So I hope that that is a logic they internalize, but it will take a lot. I think there's a lot of distrust now that's been built in the last 6 months in particular. And also, Rubio's office has been signaled to industry for at least the last year that he's a team player with them. There's an omnibus resolution at the beginning of the year where counselors are putting out their priorities here, and one that really stuck out to me, Rubio's office line item for industry-led climate thing, which is an absurd notion, like something that you would have been the, you know, the 90s, right, with, like, we thought we had a file for climate action to place, but, you know, saying that, like, we're in a climate emergency, and then functionally giving power to industry to delay further is the wild notion. Either there's politics at play, or their office doesn't sort of like grasp the emergency in the way that others do. I'm not sure, but I, you know, there's always room for research and arc, so we can always, the pressure doesn't hurt.
Well, Nick, this has actually been a pretty lousy phone connection, and so I'm wondering if we can reschedule you to come back on in a few weeks, and hopefully your catalytic converter will be fixed, and you can come into the station, and we could continue this conversation. You think that's a possibility?
Yeah, absolutely.
Offline, I will connect with you about scheduling it, but I'm thinking sometime in the next 3 or 4 weeks, so we will be in touch about that. So, anyway, thanks for being on, and thanks for, struggling through with these difficult technical things that we're going through today. But anyway, it's really good to have you on again, Nick.
Yeah, and sorry, I was the victim of pretty crime, so, but it's, I'm sorry that I was to make it there this morning, and for folks who are listening and they want a really good rundown, just read Cunningham's article, Smog, Jeremiah Hayden's Street Roots, and you'll have a really strong understanding of what's going on. Folks can always feel free to reach out to me at nick@breachclub.org.
And I have a link to Nick's article and also the Street Roots article in on the Locus Focus website. So once again, Nick, thanks so much for being on Locus Focus.
Thanks, Barbara.
We've been talking with Nick Caleb, a staff attorney with Greach Collective, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM, KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible as we climb out of this pandemic. And you can help us meet our $55,000 fall pledge drive goal during the first week of our fall membership drive by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Ray Boswell. Thank you, Ray. Next week, we'll talk with Micah Meskel with Portland Audubon about an abundance of tree issues. We'll go out with Mr. Big Stuff by Gene Knight. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
never gonna get my love. Poor girls cry when they try to keep you happy. They just try to keep you satisfied. It's the big stuff. Tell me,
who do you think you are, Mr. Big Stuff? You're never gonna get my love.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in the middle of our fall membership drive. Help us meet our $55,000 goal by making a contribution today. KBOO's organic, free-range, independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. You can also donate by texting the word KBOO to 44321 or by mailing a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Our members continue to fertilize community radio every time they give.
KBOO radio station.